Hello and welcome to our evening broadcast. Good evening, everyone. So, this year I've been asked to, I've been invited to give a talk at this TEDx conference in Hamilton. Last year I signed up for it thinking, oh well, that would be something, and ended up dropping out, realizing it wasn't really for me. This year they actually sought me out and invited me, and I wrote a speech, a talk, sent it to them, and then decided it wasn't really for me. The problem is, most of the whole idea of the conference is somewhat outside of the realm of the sorts of things that I normally talk about, right? They don't want me to come on stage and tell them a story from the Dhammapada or something. And talking about Buddhism is, so it has to be a little bit different nature. But after sending it to them, I said to them, look, you know, what I'm really comfortable with is teaching meditation. And so I scrapped that talk, and I sent them another one today. So today I wrote a talk about meditation. And I think it's, the title was Meditation Deconstructed. Anyway, the point is, well, the idea was to describe meditation from a secular point of view, or to give an explanation of meditation beyond simply the spiritual or religious description or point of view, to be able to actually explain how meditation works, why it works, in sort of scientific terms. Right? It's funny how the closest we get to this normally is studying meditation scientifically, meaning to do these trials. So you have, they've actually done clinical trials on people who practice meditation, as though meditation was this mysterious thing. We don't know how it works, but, oh, look at this, we have results to show that it works. I don't think it's quite so common to actually explain why it works, or how it works, or what it does, or what it is. So kind of this feeling that meditation is somehow this mystical or spiritual practice, when in fact it's quite simple how it works. So there's two concepts that we have to understand about meditation. First, that it's a training. I think for most of us this should be fairly clear, but for someone who's never really practiced meditation, I think it's quite common to think of it as in sort of magical terms, like, okay, I'll sit down and something will happen to me. You sit down, and so you're often waiting for these special things to happen to you. I'm doing it, why isn't it working, kind of thing. When's it going to start working? That's not how it works. Meditation is a training. You it's quite simple. You are cultivating something. So it's something you have to work at. Something when you start out you're not very good at. So it's something that takes work. It's challenging. And it's something that provides you with skills, tools. So it changes in a sense. Changes you in a sense. The second and related point that we have to understand is meditation deals with what we generally call habits. Now, a lot of meditation is just about cultivating new habits, specifically the habits of calm. So we're trying to cultivate the ability to stay calm, which means to what that means really is to cultivate that as a habit, because that's how the mind works. The mind doesn't work in terms of switches where suddenly I'll turn on the calm switch. You try to be calm, well, you've got lots of other habits. You know, your mind has other ideas. And so this is what you're faced up against, and why meditation is quite challenging, because we've got lots of bad habits, habits that are contrary to the sort of habit that we're trying to cultivate in meditation. So in terms of, to understand this clearly, you have to separate meditation into two types. There's tranquility meditation, of course, and insight meditation. So tranquility meditation is trying to cultivate the habit of calm. We're trying to practice staying calm or being calm repeatedly, so that eventually it's something you can slip into. It's like it becomes more like a switch that you can just turn on, because you've developed that habit, and when you incline in that direction, power of your training calms you down, or allows you to enter into peaceful states. And the practice of insight, the other one, where you're trying to cultivate the habit of, well, you are trying to cultivate a habit, but an easier way of understanding it is you're trying to understand your habits rather than trying to change them specifically or directly. You're trying to study them. You're studying your own mind. The idea being that when you study and learn about all your bad habits, even bad and good habits, is you'll start to change naturally. You'll be better informed and better aware of the sorts of things that become bad habits and thereby cause you suffering, and that which leads to good habits and happiness. So they're similar in some ways, and they're different in others. Tranquility is much more about cultivating these habits to the exclusion of other habits, right? Cultivating calm and more or less ignoring the, or avoiding disturbance. Now, there are some meditations that incorporate both tranquility and insight, and there's a lot of debate about these two categories, but there definitely are meditations that just practice tranquility to the exclusion of other states, just trying to keep the mind from getting involved in the problems. So loving kindness, for example, you cultivate love, and that's a habit. It's a good habit because it calms you down. That's one. When you feel angry, rather than delving into why you're angry and what it's like to be angry, you just say, nope, I'm not going to be angry. I'm going to love this person or love these people, or I'm going to have friendliness towards them. It's called the suppression by opposites. And so you suppress the bad feelings, and you become calm as a result. Now with insight meditation, instead, you, as we know, you try to learn about the habits. You'll actually, your habit is simply to try to be objective. So you spend your time focusing on good habits. You put aside the idea, the preconception of what is good and bad, and right and wrong, and you try to figure out, you try to learn objectively what is right and wrong, good and bad. And so this is the practice that I teach, that we practice here. It's a little bit disappointing, I think, sometimes. No matter how hard we try, we come to meditation with this preconception that it should be pleasant and peaceful. But insight meditation isn't always pleasant or peaceful. In fact, it's meant to be challenging. It's meant to challenge you. It's meant to try your patience and push you to be more patient. It's meant to more or less force you into being patient and objective, because if you're not, it's quite unpleasant. You're having to deal with all of the negative mind states. All of the things that normally cause you suffering, well, that cause you stress, that make you react, you have to deal with them. But the simple idea, this is the way insight meditation works, to put it simply, is by looking, by understanding, by watching all of the many inclinations of the mind, you're able to sort them out. You're able to see, oh, this one leads me to suffering, this one leads me to happiness. Now, the problem with insight meditation, particularly, or another problem with insight meditation is that you can't directly observe your habits, right? I think important in helping understand the format that meditation takes, that insight meditation takes, is, for example, you take our tradition where we focus on the stomach. This is our basic object of observation. Well, why are we focusing on the stomach, right? When we do walking meditation, what's the point? It can be difficult to connect this practice with the practice of insight. Trying to understand your mind, why are we so focused on the body? And the general tradition is to compare the quest or the task of trying to chase the mind, of trying to understand the habits of the mind. It's similar to a hunter trying to chase a wild animal through the forest. Now, hunters don't do this. And so that we have this problem in meditation, because it's similar. You try to chase the mind, you'll never catch it. It's too fast. It's very difficult to catch the mind. When you're going to do sit down and mind, where is my mind? Not an easy thing. So like a good hunter, what they do is they won't go running through the forest. What they'll do is they'll go to where they know the animals will go. They'll go to the water hole, or they'll go under a fruit tree, or somewhere where it is the habitual resting ground or feeding ground of the animal, and they'll wait. So this is what we do. This is why we focus on the body. We're not interested in the stomach rising and falling. It's not of great interest to us. What's more interesting is how the mind interacts with the rising and falling of the stomach. And when we walk, we're not interested so much in the foot. Feet aren't that interesting. But we're interested in how the mind interacts with it. And so the body is sort of this intermediary, this catalyst that allows us to understand the mind. When you watch the stomach, that's why, it's always interesting. People watch the stomach and say, well, it's just, I'm not really comfortable with this technique. It's causing all sorts of problems for me. And that's the point. So we want to see that. We want to watch the mind when it's challenged. See how the mind deals with things that it's not very clear about, or it's not really comfortable with. So the stomach is, you think, well, why am I focusing on this? I really know and my stomach's not, there's not going to be anything interesting there. But what's interesting is to watch how the mind doesn't really know the stomach or doesn't really understand how the body works. It has a lot of misconceptions. So we try to control the body. We think that we're in control of the stomach rising and falling. We try to make it comfortable. We try to make it stable. We're really out of touch with how reality works. And that's what we want to see. That's what we want to learn. And to learn how the mind really works, also how the body really works, how reality works. Because our, the last point that I want to talk about in this talk that I've just sort of started to write is because insight meditation changes the way we look at the world. The problem, the big sort of overarching problem that we have is that our whole way of looking at the world, it's based on concepts. It's based on what we think of things. So, for example, people. Everyone that we know, we have ideas about them. We think of them as individuals, as entities. So this person is like this, that person is like that. This is what I like about this person, this is what I dislike about them. And we get these ideas in our minds about how things should be, about how things are. But they're all conceptual. When our ideas about a person are based on our experiences, but we never experience the person. You can never experience another individual or experience another thing. When you see this computer in front of you, you're not experiencing the computer. You're experiencing sight and extrapolating that there's a computer actually in front of you. And this is, I mean, it may seem somewhat philosophical, but it's quite important because we're able to gain, to acquire all sorts of conceptual ideas about these things. Like, this computer is mine, that person is my husband or wife or parent or child, that person is my friend, my enemy, good, bad. And our expectations come from this. We cultivate all sorts of expectations and hopes and wishes. Without really paying much attention to the way things actually work. And so when things go not according to our expectations, we suffer. So the shift that comes about is we start to look at the world in terms of experience. We start to see that, well, my suffering is caused because I have these conceptions about people. This person didn't act the way I wanted them to act or expected them to act. Or this thing that I thought was mine, it disappeared or it was taken or stolen. I can't control, I can't keep, I've lost the things, or things have changed. Even our own bodies, thinking we're in control of our bodies as entities. And we suffer as a result of these unmet expectations. So once we start to see the world in terms of experience, this starts to fade away. We're able to watch moment by moment our experience, seeing it arise and cease, and realizing, and just being able to see through our expectations, so that instead of wanting or wishing for things to be a certain way, we're more flexible and adaptive to the way things are. We see that reality isn't made up of things that we can control or depend upon. You know, we see how suffering works, how it comes about. It comes because we want things to be a certain way and they're another way. And we start to realize that these wants and these desires and these conceptions of things are causing us suffering. So we make this shift to look at reality and see the present moment and to learn how to live here and now. It kind of becomes scientific, right? A scientific inquiry. Science is very much against, or modern science, very much against this idea of subjective reality, that you could actually learn something from your own experience, right? Because we're so easily deceived by our senses. It goes back to Descartes, right? I've talked about this before. Descartes realized that he could be deceived about pretty much everything. And he was trying to figure out what he couldn't be deceived about. That's where he came up with this, I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum. Because I can't be deceived about that. It's a bit more important than it might sound. You think, well, that's pretty minimal. But you can't be deceived about what you actually, about actual experience. You know, if you experience seeing, you're actually seeing. There is actually seeing. What you're seeing is up for debate. It's up for debate because those things are abstract. And that's where the problem comes from. You can have a conception of something and reality could be totally different. Or your conceptions are static and reality is not static. But more importantly, when you start to see, you know, what's so important about this idea of actually knowing something, is that you can't be deceived. I'm suffering. I'm, you know, and this is causing me suffering. When you're angry, you will see the result of anger. No one can tell you that that's not the result of anger because you're watching it happen, and you watch it happen again and again, and then you have no doubt. You can't possibly question this, that anger leads to certain results. If you want something, you start to learn about wanting, and you say, wanting has certain effects. It changes us in certain ways. It has this effect on the mind. When you're clear, when your mind is clear and you see things as they are, it changes the way your mind works. It changes your reality. It changes your responses, and you can see that. You're actually able to make certain observations and come to conclusions without any doubt. There's more that you can know than scientists are really willing to admit, or would care to admit. And meditation is actually a process by which you can come to know things. You come to know the nature of the basis of experiential reality. You know that seeing is seeing, hearing is hearing. But then you also see cause and effect. You come to see what leads to suffering, what leads to happiness, and thereby what is good and what is bad. And we're often hesitant to think in terms of good and bad or to categorize experiences, right? Good and bad are so contentious. But not for a meditator. There's no need to dogmatize or to theorize about what is good or what is bad. Because when you practice meditation, you will see for yourself, this is good, this is bad. You don't need someone to tell you. You don't have to believe it and say, oh, this is bad. You have no question. There's no debate in the mind. This is bad. Someone could tell you, well, no, it's actually good for something. And it's very difficult to believe them. You'd have to ignore what you're seeing in order to believe them, because it's clearly bad. It's causing suffering, it's causing stress, it has no benefit, and you can see that. This is insight meditation. So this is sort of what I'm trying to get at in this talk. I wrote it out and have to go over it in the coming days. But I thought I'd share it with you. Sort of this idea of trying to understand meditation, not being content with it being some sort of magical practice that somehow benefits me in ways I'm not really clear, but hey, it seems to work. but to actually understand how it works, why it works, what it does, and how it's not something mysterious or hard to understand. So there you go. That's the Dhamma for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. If there are any questions, I'm happy to take them, or comments. No questions. All right. Well, thank you all for coming out. See you all next time. Hello. Hello. Oh, did I lose my audio? Hello. Oh. How did I lose my audio? What was the last thing I said? Here I am talking. Are there any questions? If there are no questions, oh, here's one. Okay. How much meditation would you recommend for a beginner? Some say to start small and to increase gradually. Yeah, I mean, there's no such thing really as too much meditation. The problem is being able to meditate in great amounts properly. So without a teacher, there's much more room for error. And if you just push on ahead, it's easier to cultivate bad habits without feedback. So one good thing about moderating your practice is the ability to step back and see how it interacts with your life. I mean, ideally, you want to do lots and lots of meditation all day. But without a teacher to help you, it's very, you just get off track. So that's sort of the criteria of, in terms of answering this question. For most people, you don't want to do too much meditation because you won't be meditating properly. So it's sort of an exploratory sort of practice. Do some. Don't push yourself too hard, because you'll just cause yourself lots of stress. Yeah, I mean, we want to do more, do as much as you can, basically. But there's a limit on sort of how much you can benefit from before you start to, the stress becomes too much and it's no longer all that beneficial. Until you have some instruction, some guidance, and are able to deal with some more, the deeper emotions that come out, the states that come out of intensive meditation practice. But there's no, I can't quantify. Just give you some guidance, some guidelines in that sense. Don't push yourself too hard. It's not something to be afraid of. It's just to be aware that it is possible to meditate wrong, and doing moderate amounts better allows you to sort of gauge what you're getting out of it, what it's doing to you, that kind of thing. Until you have more experience doing a lot of meditation. Can you explain what it is when you are always meditating? This occurs most of my day. So when I log my meditation hours, I end up not logging them in because it would be always. Suppose I describe it as remaining with self, like I'm watching over my entire being for many moments of the day. Yes, well, meditation for us is, it's two parts. One is the quality of mind, the sort of thing that you seem to be describing, and the other is the actual work that you do to cultivate it. So an enlightened being is always mindful, but in order to become mindful, we have techniques, and the technique we use is the use of a mantra. So our meditation practice all day would be to be reminding ourselves when you walk to say to yourself, walking, walking. When you eat to say to yourself, chewing, chewing, swallowing. And it's an important distinction because the quality of your state is highly subjective. You can say, I'm enlightened or I'm mindful even all the time, but that's how you perceive it. It may very well not be that way. See, the key in insight meditation is to be completely objective and have a clear mind. It's very difficult to do. It's more difficult than it sounds. It's very easy to fall into the idea that you, or to fall into the conception that you're clear of mind, when in fact you're not. You can be quite partial and biased and confused, conflating calm with clarity. So having this technique that keeps you honest and keeps you objective, forces you to be objective. When you say to yourself, seeing, seeing, there's not much room for any partiality, subjectivity, or getting off track. It pushes the mind to see seeing as seeing. It's quite useful in directing your mind in the right way so that you become more objective. So we would focus more on cultivating the technique throughout the day rather than trying purposefully to cultivate certain qualities of mind. And we're much more concerned about the actual technique. Okay. Because qualities are well, you mean cultivating the qualities is not really the practice. The qualities come from applying the technique. It's not just about saying, I'm gonna be very mindful today and doing that intentionally. That's problematic. It's just a concept and you have this idea of what it means to be mindful, and it's very much associated with the ego and self, trying to control, trying to make your mind mindful. What is the difference between rupa and nama? Couldn't we say that there is only nama, as the awareness of the existence of rupa is done through nama, thinking, thinking? Well, you have to understand, nama rupa is a description of the aspects of experience. Now, there's only experience. And yes, the Buddha did say vijnana paccaya nama rupa, so it all comes from consciousness. But what he's saying is our experience, a moment of experience, of conscious experience, is made up of two parts, up to two parts. Some is just mental, but the physical aspect is a part of the experience. So yes, it's all experience is all mental. There's no question. But that experience has two parts. It has the physical aspect, and it generally has two parts, the physical and the mental aspect. So the physical is again this hardness and softness. That's physical. The mental aspect is the consciousness and also the liking and disliking and so on. Did I lose audio again? Hello? Hello, hello? Did I lose audio? What's going on? Oops. Hello, hello. Hello, hello. Hello, hello. Testing, testing. I don't know what happened. Am I still there? It's a problem with Second Life, maybe. Hello, hello. How's the sound? Hello, hello, hello. Testing, testing. Hello, hello. Hello, hello. Hello, hello. Hello, hello. Test, test. All right. Well, apologies for that. I don't know what's wrong. Those of you listening in the audio, I'll just say goodnight. See you all next time.